The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Kentucky Workers' Comp Fund Specialist. You don't become a specialist overnight. Just ask Ben Brumley of Cardinal Carrier. Our company has been in business for 54 years.
Adam Proctor is a scholar in neo-Marxian state theory and class formation. He is also a member of the DSA and the host of one of the new left podcasts. His Dead Pundit Society podcast has arrived on the podcasting scene with a roar. It's Wednesday, September 27th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand late capitalism, pick up Anselm Japp's The Writing on the Wall, which is a collection that brings an understanding of Marx's value theory to bear on political questions, Chris Nynum's How the Establishment Lost Control, and of course, Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies, which is turning out to be a great conversation piece. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. The music you're listening to right now is Climbing the Corporate Ladder by Enmesh. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Adam Proctor and I discuss free speech, communism, and the DSA. Adam Proctor is a scholar in neo-Marxian state theory and class formation, labor history in the 20th century, and the development of racial formations. He's also a member of the DSA and the host of one of the new leftist podcasts that make me feel old and out of touch. His Dead Pundit Society podcast has arrived on the podcasting scene with a roar, as Adam has interviewed a slew of very smart guests, including Christian Parente, Adolf Reed, and Zero Books' own Angela Nagel. Adam Proctor, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Very glad to be on your show, Doug. I've been a listener of your show for a long time, as you know, ever since the Diet Soap days.
Back when you were in grade school, right?
Back when I was in grade school, actually still in graduate school, you know, for the last 20 years. Only got 10 more to go. So
you've not managed to steer clear of controversy. You arrived on the scene with your Dead Pundits podcast. And immediately, I think, started stirring the shit. What do you think your most controversial stance has been? Is it your free speech absolutism, your critique of wokeness, your anti-essentialism? What would you think is getting you the most trouble?
All of the above, really. But if I had to choose one, I would say, it's odd because my critique of wokeness, you would think, would really just grate against this kind of like woke liberal, neoliberal center, right? The NGO foundation center left, you know, think about the DeRay McKessons of the world, right? And the people who are at the national leadership position of Black Lives Matter, for example. And you'd think that I would be getting a lot of scorn and a lot of attention from those folks, but they don't really notice. They have a project for themselves. The people who are really throwing the most shit at me are our other lefties, and particularly because of the free speech stuff. They hated the three-part series that I did on free speech. I started with Christian Parente. I moved to Freddie DeBoer, and then finally landed with Angela Nagel, our beloved Angela Nagel. She's fantastic.
Yeah, she's great. And she's been suffering her own slings and arrows. I am not surprised anymore, but disappointed to hear that the free speech absolutism is your most controversial stance.
Absolutely, yeah. And so Lee Fang is another guy out there. It's because it's morphed now. It's morphed into my critique of Antifa. has really taken on the same kind of flavor as my critique of free speech. Because for me, I mean, we may disagree on this, I'm not sure, but for me, my what you call free speech absolutism, it's not a moral position. I could give a fuck less, to be honest. I really could. I'm not going to debate about the, you know, the morality of this or that or the other. For me, it's strategic. For me, it's absolutely strategic. And I because my conviction is that the left, as marginal and as powerless and as lacking capacities as we are, cannot win by trying to use appeal to authority to squash a speech that we don't like, because we will necessarily be the next victim. And so it's, for me, it's 100% strategic. And as well as, I mean, I'm just really cribbing on Angela Nagel right now by saying, like, in addition to that, like, this anti-free speech culture has absolutely killed the left's desire and ability to make persuasive arguments to the masses of people, right? We don't know how to speak to normies anymore because they're too problematic. If people are deemed to be problematic, or they have bad politics in one area, then they, you know, they're not deemed to be in our audience, and therefore we don't need to make arguments, and therefore we can just kind of you know, disregard them and try to no platform them if they come to our events. And to be clear, I'm not talking about preaching to Charles Murray. I'm not trying to convert Ann Coulter. But what I'm suggesting is that, or not even their followers, right? But what I'm suggesting is that, like, there's an audience that's watching us. They're watching what we do from the outside. They're the lurkers. The vast majority of people are the lurkers of this world. They're not on left. They're not on Twitter, but they see what we do. And when they see us acting like petulant children and stamping our feet and putting our fingers in our ears. Now, even if that's not what we're doing, that's what they see, right? That's the optics of the thing. And so for me, my free speech absolutism is absolutely strategic. I think it's the only way that we can win.
I agree with you about it being a strategic decision, and that it's the right, you know, it's right to hold that position for strategic reasons. I would go a little further. I don't know if I would say it's a moral good, but I would just say that if you're interested in establishing the truth of something, that holding a free speech absolutist position is the only sensible position to hold. That. And I believe strategically, the left is in desperate need of reassessing and establishing the truth of its own project. So not only aren't we good at talking to people who aren't inside of our group, we're not good at talking to each other either.
Right. That's the correlate. You're absolutely right to point to that. And I think that really is the correlate. So I have no disagreement there. Because one of the things that I've discovered recently in my, and we can talk about this later, this is a more recent controversy, right? And some of the quarrels within and around DSA. What I've discovered is that, yes, you're right. Our inability to talk to the outside world has translated to our inability to talk to our internal sphere, our internal networks, and to make persuasive arguments, to accept a certain degree of heterodoxy, right? To be able to make to identify the most essential aims and goals that you possess and then communicate them effectively to people who might not share them directly.
You get ensconced in a particular theoretical outlook. Let's just say, because this is what I've encountered, let's say you're pretty ensconced in critical race theory of various types, and you encounter someone who's also on the left, because that's a kind of a left position, but they don't agree with critical race theory. They have a critique of it. Okay? You do not approach, most of the time, that isn't approached as a critique. It's an approach as an attack.
Yeah. Yeah. That person's being problematic. like me, for example. Yeah.
Somebody's got to be right. And maybe neither one is completely right. I mean, obviously, neither one is going to be completely right. But if we can't discuss the differences in opinion that are based on kind of complex theory, yeah, and instead revert to this sort of war approach,
yeah,
we're never going to make any progress in organizing ourselves and to changing society. And it gets to be, there gets to be a point for me where I feel like that isn't even the aim anymore for most of what goes on in the name of the left. That we have fully accommodated ourselves into the system that is, and that what's going on around left theory is jockeying for positions, whether it's regarding, you know, in terms of like media outlets or university positions or just how many Twitter followers you have and who's saying that they like you the most on social media.
So you're pointing to it. You raised a lot of really important issues. I like the way you frame that. So I want to start with the last bit and bookmark it to come back to it. What you're pointing to are these really kind of convoluted, crisscrossing and internalized incentive structures that emerge, right? And you can look at this. I mean, this is the way that institutions work, right? There, you can look at some people have called this the iron law of bureaucracy, you know, if you're a Weberian or whatever. There's a little iron law of oligarchy. Robert Michels was a French guy at the turn of the century who wrote a really great pamphlet on the trouble of like political party organization, called it the iron law of oligarchy. So that's when incentive structures sort of lose their way and the aims that you originally set out to achieve become twisted as the incentives shift, right? So it's not so much changing the world anymore. It's about building your own personal brand, which means Twitter followers and staking out these narcissism of small differences, right? And that kind of thing. And I think that's really where we're at right now on the left. And one of the problems is that the broadly Hegelian Marxist left theoretical canon is not at all equipped to investigate internal interpersonal dynamics. Sadly, like, I mean, the really shitty bourgeois liberal, like Chicago School of Sociology, for example, or like symbolic interactionism, or for those who have had to take a sociology 101 class or whatever, those are the places where you actually see investigations of interpersonal and intergroup dynamics about status and hierarchy. And in-group, in-group cohesion is fostered by out-group aggression. There's internal, external dynamics. And Marxism and left theory and discourse doesn't really have an apparatus for us to be able to analyze those dynamics that are going on underneath of our own noses, so to speak. And so that's a real problem that I'm discovering. Likewise, we don't really have a good language to talk about like interpersonal communication and dynamics as well. And so a lot of the what we call debate that goes on online is really just kind of veiled abuse. I mean, it really is. I mean, I would never tolerate that from a romantic partner or a family member or a roommate or anybody. I would never tolerate it. No, nobody to bus stop, right? Because I mean, the level of there's projection, right? Yeah, I project what I see. What I want onto you, and there, you know, so there's this straw manning that's going on, and projection, just bad faith interpretations that go down, you know, and so we've mistaken debate and discussion for, you know, it's just abuse. I mean, these dynamics are just openly abusive. It's I don't like what you have to say, so I'm going to come up with as many ways as I can that I can hurt you as possible. Right. So that's where this trolling happens on Twitter. And I realized that some months ago, man, I just realized like these people aren't debating with me. They're just coming up with ever more creative ways to hurt me. I mean, really to hurt me, you know, psychologically, to troll me, to make my day just a little bit shittier.
The point to underscore here is that while that is not an indictment of these people's character, strangely enough. I mean, it is maybe, but
yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
You know, it's something that's going on within the space. It's almost like structured into the space.
Yeah, right. That's because it's the incentive structures. I mean, I'm not a media theory guy, a media studies guy, but we could have a real field day. I mean, I think of Marshall McLuhan. The media is the message, right? So it's the idea that like we mistake the message for like the words on the screen, but the medium is Twitter. And Twitter has a certain material orientation. It has certain constraints of, okay, 140 characters. It has certain incentive structures built in. You have the little heart. You have the retweet. You have threads. You know, you can tag people. There's hashtags. And so, like, I think Alfie Brown, an author of yours under the
Zero. It's Alfie Bown, actually. B-O-W-N, Bown.
Alfie Bown, he would be great at talking about this, the way that technology structures communication and then the way that there sort of shapes the way that the discourse manifests itself. So I think you're right to point to like, yeah, there is some personal culpability to go around for sure, but we can't just totally chalk it up to that, I think.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, when you notice that you're caught in this sort of structure, it's on you to change your relationship to, say, social media or to people on social media if you really understand what's happening. We can get into the weeds about just moral theory here if we wanted to. Like, do people – like, I have almost a platonic approach to this. I think if people know the truth, then they will do what is right. But that is not necessarily the case. But if you are – you know, if you do know the truth about this or suspect it, then you have moral culpability. I think a lot of people just don't see what they're involved in very clearly.
Right. So there's this emphasis on purity, and that if you start to look at intergroup dynamics, and it's funny, I actually just happened to thumb through that essay, Glenn's essay, this morning. I found it by accident. It was in a wrong pile on my desk, and so I moved it elsewhere. But I happened to notice that he was actually pulling from a lot of that Chicago school sociology stuff, right? That internal group dynamics stuff. And I mean, the idea that, like, if you turn to that stuff and you pull from that stuff, that you're somehow anti-Marxist or whatever. I mean, that's just fucking childish. I mean, come on, you know, we can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. You know, I'm not a Catholic. I wasn't born a Catholic, and I've never been one. And I don't have any of the impulses to Catholicism, to the internal coherence of belief, you know, and that type of thing. And I don't think that has any place on the left. Unfortunately, it comprises about 90% of it right now. The left, that is.
The question is, what kind of person would say this to us? Now, I was brought up in the high-minded tradition that ad hominem inference had no place in legitimate public debate. I believed that for many years until I started participating in public debate myself and found that it seemed to matter a great deal whether or not the article was in Commentary or it was in someplace else. I couldn't figure it out. I mean, I really, naively, I confess, didn't understand why it seemed to matter. The article was the article. It was either right or it was wrong. I mean, refute it if it's wrong. What difference does it make? But why would you publish there? Don't you know what those people are about? So it matters who's saying things. We want to know what kind of person is speaking to us. What I have in mind here is the following kind of problem. The problem where a consensus comes about that certain kinds of expression have meanings above and beyond what might literally be attempting to be conveyed. They stand in for something. They're symbolic. Then we draw the conclusion that a person who's unwilling to engage in the symbolism must not believe in some cherished value of the community. And as a consequence, we're prepared to ostracize, or worse. It's a convention about the fact that expressing oneself in a certain way conveys some larger meaning. And when we find people who willfully choose not to follow the convention, we're prepared to draw a conclusion that, in effect, they don't share the value which is symbolically reflected in that particular conventional form of expression. Now, the kicker here, the thing that makes this work, is that in many circumstances, it is correct to presume that people who don't share the value would be more willing to run the risk of ostracism by breaking the convention and expressing themselves in an unapproved way, a disapproved way. Right? It's the fact that it really is informative about the kind of person that I'm talking with to see whether or not they're prepared to labor over the gender pronoun, the third person singular, he or she. Right? I write a paper here. I use he throughout. And of course, I'm, you know, playing with my reader a bit when I do that. But it's to make my point. Then in a footnote, I say, well, of course, I could have said she. Let me just tell you, I flipped a coin at the beginning and it came up heads. So I'm saying he. But you don't believe that, do you?
I tend to think that Marx accepts a lot more of bourgeois economic theory than most Marxists think. Like, to describe the economy of branding accurately, from a bourgeois perspective, certainly isn't going to challenge Marx's critique of the, you know, of wages. You know, it probably fits just fine. It's just not describing the same thing. Look, the supply and demand fits perfectly within Marxist economics, and it just, he describes it and explains it a little differently than the bourgeois economists would, but it's still there. So I think we could even be good Catholics and look outside of our own realm to for understanding.
I am actually obsessed with internal coherence, but internal and epistemological coherence for the sake of clarity and precision of concepts, right? Not just to pay the right, respects to the right gods or whatever.
Right. I mean, there's this internal coherence that isn't coherence at all, right? It's just like, I know the list of things that I'm supposed to believe.
Just reciting the catechisms, you know, and the Marxian canon. So there's a distinction here I think would be important, I like to use, and I'm still developing it. People might have a problem with it, but they can fuck off. So, so this is the distinction I like to use between Marxian versus Marxist. Now, I am a devout, we're going Catholic here. I'm a devout Marxian. I'm at the point in my life where I want nothing to do with Marxism as it is generally and broadly understood, right? Because that's that 90% that we were talking about that I just don't identify as even remotely Marxish. There are traditions that I can pull from. There are traditions that I like a lot of the aspects of them. I've learned a great deal from those traditions, but I distinguish those traditions from what I call the Marxian tradition, which is, and there's a difference here. And I think, let me try to work this out for you. I think Marxian ideas are the ones that I try to adhere to, the kind of synthesis that Marx put together, the kind of ideas that he had, because I think they were good ideas. And I think his impulses were the right ones. And I think where he was looking and how he looked at society was the right kind of methodological perspective to have. But that's why I agree with it. I agree with it because I think they're the right, that Marx held the right ideas. And I agree. I aspire to those ideas. I think Marxism all too often aspires to the ideas because Marx held them. You see the difference? Right? And so there's this notion of like appealing to authority, and Marx is this sort of like, you know, this he's this godhead. And the ideas are correct because Marx held them or didn't. And I can prove that he did or didn't, right? That's the history of Marxology. Right? Whereas I am interested in the ideas that he held because I think they were good ones. So let's talk about those ideas. Let's talk about how they related to his time. And let's talk about how they maybe differ and how that kind of methodological posture that he had might translate to our own era.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm with you completely. The way I put it is slightly different. I call myself a wannabe Marxist. Because
you're not giving yourself enough credit there. I've heard you say that before. I mean, I feel like you're aspiring to something that sucks. You're better than that.
okay. But what I mean by that is I'm a wannabe Marxist in the way that people are wannabe Christians or struggling to be Christian. You know, like I understand that there's, you know, a deep understanding in Marx. I haven't read everything he's written, so I don't think I could claim to be Marxist if the criteria is to fully understand his work. Because I haven't read it all. But so I'm a wannabe Marxist, which just means I want to explore what he said and understand it better. And, you know, I don't spend enough time going to church, and I don't spend enough time reading Marx. But I think your distinction is much more clear. I think that's a really good one.
Well, that's good, because I kind of pulled it out of my ass. But I think it works. I really do. And I'm developing it as I go on. Because, you know, I'm not a value theory guy. For your audience who knows, and I think you and I have talked about this, I'm really not. I mean, I think Marx developed a very interesting crisis theory, but there's the problem that's just kind of eternal in Marxism, which is that, you know, they say Marxists have predicted 30 of the last 7 global crises, right? And so there's always a crisis. I mean, you know, come on. Everyday conditions of capitalism are the crisis, right? And they always have been. And so capitalism is always about finding barriers, smashing barriers, and then producing a shitstorm in the wake of that.
You want to know my answer to that? It's that those people who got it wrong just clearly didn't understand Marx well enough.
And I can prove it. I've got the text here from the mega archive, the Marx Engels Gesamte Ausgabe Part 2 that I spent 10 years at researching in Germany. Yeah.
Yeah. So great. So, but here's the thing. I think that I am kind of a value guy, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'll read it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And but from my perspective, like, this is the kind of debate, whether or not Marx's labor theory of value holds or not, that really is important to have. Of course, I think that because I think it does hold, but if it has consequences, and it isn't about, you know, like, I don't think me holding with Marx's labor theory of value makes me particularly moral or a better anything. It just means I have this belief and there are consequences to it, and I want to convince other people about that. But it doesn't mean that when I go to out in the world, I'm more likely to, I don't know, I'm not woke. You don't get woke.
So you don't get to receive like a special communion because you're a value theory guy, whereas I will be denied the cup of wine and the cracker.
No, it just means that you and I have to argue about this stuff all the time. So,
Well, let me jump on that, though, because Diane L., here's a great book if you haven't seen it. A lot of people haven't. I'm not a labor theory of value guy. Wait for it. I'm a value theory of labor guy. And I think the distinction is a really sharp one, I think, and because what it does – and this is a concept created by Diane Elson, among others. Diane Elson has a edited volume that was, I think, re-released by Verso Books very recently. Everybody should go check it out. Diane Elson, The Value Theory of Labor. And what she does there is she argues that value is something that is this kind of like abstract notion that's created by capitalism. So she overcomes – I mean, she does a lot. It does a lot of work. But what she's able to do is overcome the kind of like the naturalism that's inherent in the labor theory of value, the tie, the material, the notion that value then, because it's produced by labor, has this kind of material existence in commodities. Whereas in Marx, value is never material; it's only ever realized after the fact, and even then it can be transformed if a crisis comes around and shows you that actually, ha ha ha, all that value you thought was produced in that housing boom is now worth fucking nothing. And it's interesting work.
Capitalism. It's what gives us 200 kinds of cars, 4 million kinds of apps, and 57 kinds of Hemsworths. But what is it exactly? Capitalism is a man-made economic system based on profit. It takes wealth and resources away from the public and puts it in the hands of private capitalists.
So, okay, let's talk about the DSA.
Yeah.
You've been involved with the DSA for a little while. Just what kind of organization is the DSA? And where did it splinter off from? And what is its political orientation? Let's start there.
Jeez, I am not the guy to talk about the history of DSA, but I mean, I'll start from now, and I'm going to be very. Let me start with a quick caveat. I think DSA is the most important political innovation, advance, potential in left politics in maybe 35 years. It's something that I'm incredibly excited about. Whether or not I always agree ideologically, that doesn't matter. It is the most exciting thing to come along in a long time. And that's not just me saying it. There are people from across the ideological spectrum who are saying this. They're more soft liberal social democrats. They're hardcore communists who are saying this. And it's a really exciting thing. But with that being said, I think the DSA is in trouble. I do. And I say this with love. I say this the way you talk about your child in hushed tones, you know, with your child psychologist or something like that. And I think that primarily DSA is in trouble, mostly because most of the members have no idea that they are in trouble. I'm not a soldier in the DSA Army. I have been in a lot of socialist organizations in the past. I've done a lot of door knocking, a lot of organizing, a lot of branch building. I've started branches from the ground up and so on and so forth. So I've done that kind of work before, but I'm not currently involved in that work in DSA, but I am in constant, almost daily communication with leadership from across the country, with just rank and file across the country. And as well as national leadership as well, and people who have been around the organization for decades. And so I have a pretty good bird's eye view of what's going on. And, you know, when I go to meetings, I find that there is a kind of disconnectedness with the broader political entity that is the DSA in some of these local branches. And there's a localism that really prevails, which is fine, right? Nose to the grindstone, knock on those fucking doors, get those socialist, self-identified socialist politicians elected or whatever to city council, to the school board, to dog catcher. You got to do that base building work. You know, walk those picket lines, right? Build those unions. You got to do that work. But what scares me about this moment is that it's so fraught with contradictions and difficulties, and I'm not sure that the membership is aware enough of how their individual activity fits into the bigger puzzle that's being constructed. They're under the belief that there's this kind of like confederationalism, that we're just going to build here, and everybody else is going to do that where they are, and it's all going to add up to paint this beautiful picture. And unfortunately, the history of national political organizations haven't quite worked out that way. These are unwieldy vessels that require a great deal of coordination and steering and constant reevaluation and assessment, because just as fast as DSA came up, it could fall. SDS, Students for Democratic Society, which was the last big groundswell of what you might call left social democratic, socialist, communist kind of young people organizing. From what I'm told, I also don't know the history of this, but from what I'm told, SDS collapsed almost overnight. I think they went from 200,000 members across the country to next to nothing in a matter of months.
I asked you what the political orientation was of DSA.
Yeah, good question. So it came out of Michael Harrington and the realignment strategy on the Democratic Party in the late 1960s. I'm actually going to be doing a series on this in the Dead Pundit Society in the coming weeks, so everybody should tune in. It's a little self-plug, but shameless plug, but it's important. I mean, I think the political moment we're in right now comes from that realignment strategy, right? Yeah, where there were open racist segregationalists inside of the Democratic Party, the Dixiecrats. And there was a group of young, multiracial, you know, in some senses, leftist cadres who said, we got to get these old racist bastards out of the party, because that's the only way that we're ever going to have a party, a Democratic Party that will fight for progressive reforms, that will further the Great Society project, that will further the anti-racist kind of civil rights agenda, the pro-labor agenda, and so on and so forth. And so the realignment strategy was successful. As much as we like on the left like to talk about how that was an utter failure in the Democratic Party as a cesspool, and it is. It was successful in one respect, which is that it kicked out the segregationists in the far right wing of the Democratic Party. But so Michael Harrington were in, and his cadres were part of that struggle in a big way. And DSA came out of some fragmentations and some joint and some splits and some unifications. And they really kind of took the same trajectory that what we call the New Left took, which is they more or less kind of flooded their way into the Democratic Party. They maintained a sort of inward, outward sort of, you know, you think about the Rainbow Coalition with Jesse Jackson in the 80s, some other independent campaigns that came around. But they've really just functioned as the left wing of the Democratic Party for a long time. Until Bernie Sanders' campaign kind of came along and made social democracy, democratic socialism rather cool again, right? And I think, you know, long story short, DSA is up to 25,000 members. You know, there's a lot of ideological fragmentation going on. There's a new communist caucus that just came up. They've kind of got a lot of heat, a lot of flack for their orientation to the larger group. There's anarcho, syndicalists. There's all types of different tendencies that are kind of in there. I think broadly speaking, you have the older members who are kind of Harringtonites or soft social democrats, I would say. Although in that grouping, there's some of the most militant labor organizers in the country, you know. And so I think it's, we would be remiss in papering over these older members of DSA as these kind of softy liberal types, because there's some of these people, we could learn a lot from these folks.
Does the DSA mostly aim itself at the Democratic Party, at shifting it or moving it about?
No longer. I would say for certainly since the convention that was held this summer, where they decisively moved away from that, there was a proposal, a resolution that was rejected, which was basically to say, like, we're completely done with the Democratic Party. We're never going to worry to them ever again. It lost by a small margin. So the question is still an open one about what that relationship might look like. For example, if you can find a socialist who has good politics who could run on the Democratic Party ticket, they might take that opportunity, or they might endorse Bernie Sanders again if he runs as a Democrat. That kind of thing. So that's there open on the table, I would say.
Years and years ago, back around 2002, I was involved with a peace organization called Portland Peaceful Response Coalition. And what you're talking about happening inside the DSA happened inside that peace group.
You mean the fragmentation?
Fragmentation, different caucuses, different little groups. So, yeah, there was an anarchist contingency. There was a Marxist contingency, but they didn't organize together openly. And they didn't agree enough to do so.
of course. Right.
They were all these. They had the different newspapers to sell.
And then
there were various degrees of liberals. But the main split was between the hard left and the soft left inside PPRC. And what happened was the soft left won. And the hard left went off and did nothing, basically. They just sort of left the organization, making pronouncements and leaving. And the hard left was really interesting, though, because it wasn't really a coherent group. I mean, there were radical feminists on the hard left, younger radical feminists on the hard left. The so-called radical feminists that were older were part of the soft left. And it wasn't because of their ideology. It was other things. Then they were running in different social circles, really, is all it came down to. Then
it's cliques, right? Different cliques.
Yeah, they're all these little cliques. And what I recognized when I was in the group was that most of what was going on, especially after hours, and people would drag me off and say, we got to go talk, you know, this is important, is it was sort of your typical, you know, social gathering. It was like some people were trying to get laid.
That's a big thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it was not actually about politics at all.
Yeah. I think, you know, my original stance on caucuses when it was an open question for the convention was that I was anti-caucus. Because there was this, some folks will listen to my episode with Adolf Reed, where he chimed in with his experience with racialized caucuses, race-based, identity-based caucuses, in the American Labor Party in the 1990s. And it was a useful sort of cautionary tale, I think. But I lost that argument heavily. I think that resolution to found an Afro-socialist POC caucus in DSA passed by like 95% or more. So fine, I lost. You know, you win some, you lose some. Marx lost his argument against the Goethe program. You know, I mean,
yeah, right.
You know,
he didn't even really make his argument fully.
Didn't even really make it, but you know, I mean, it's just say, you know, I think so, you know, just because you, I mean, a lot of people say like, well, Adam, you know, you lost, so get out of here, get lost, man. And it's like, losing is not necessarily like historically the best marker of like how things will ultimately play out in the long run. So, you know, my argument against the identity caucuses in particular, the identity caucuses, is that number one, it presumes, it equates identity, it essentializes an identity or a race or a gender with a certain ideological outlook, which is just not true. It's just not true that all of the black identified members in DSA have the same politics. They do not, you know, or women or trans people or anyone. They just do not. Cedric Johnson was on my show as well. Some folks will know. And his big argument in an article he recently wrote is that race does not equal political constituency. That's been the fundamental flaw of race politics for the last 50 years. We assume that because you have certain racial characteristics, that you will necessarily have certain political inclinations and desires. And that just has not ever been true. Race has never been enough to cohere a political constituency. And so we're kind of, you know, when you found a caucus under an identity, you're playing make believe in that way. And also it becomes a bully pulpit for folks, for a very small minority of people. I'm not talking like two or three people, right? Can take over these caucuses and they can wield them. And because it's a caucus, they're given a certain air of legitimacy, right? For example, the DSA Veterans Caucus had a tremendous influence inside of DSA when this Danny Fatante crisis was going on. A lot of folks will be vaguely familiar with that. And what I find is, okay, DSA veterans, that's a great thing. I'm glad it exists. They have a lot of important work they could be doing to help veterans and fight war, you know, to promote an anti-war stance in the U.S. But they took on this kind of battle against Danny Fatante. And agree or disagree, they really had an outsized influence in the organization. And as it turns out, there's only maybe these statements that were put out by these guys were written by like the same two or three guys. And if they were just two or three individuals who were members of the organization, maybe nobody would even pay attention to them. But because they have the title of being the DSA Veterans, you know, working group, they have this air of extra additional legitimacy that's granted to them that I think is potentially really dangerous and certainly anti-democratic.
When you have a caucus or a working group, is the idea to actually do battle within the group to try to figure out the DSA stance on particular issues? Is it like this is a working group that's coming up with policy and that then gets voted on by the majority or something else going on in these caucuses?
In practice, no. I think the charitable answer would be to say that it's too early for that type of more mature feedback kind of objective oriented approach to happen, because really what's happening is it's a way to meet like-minded people across the country. You know, maybe if you like a bunch of people on Twitter and you're not in the same chapter, you can sort of form this caucus and then all of a sudden now we have this working affiliation together. In the way that caucuses, and I've slightly modified my view on caucuses because I think it can be a useful thing to transcend the local, right? If I'm a Washington DC area DSA member on paper, right? So my day-to-day interaction with DSA is going to happen in that deep, broad DSA chapter. We have a series of branches actually, but that's going to be where I go to meetings. Those are going to be the people that I see. That's going to be the work that I do. Now, if I want to broaden outside of that and work at the national level, well, I can get elected to NPC, but only a handful of people get to do that. Or I can become a part of a caucus, and suddenly I'm plugged into a network of people across the country. So I've modified my stance on caucuses a little bit because I think that can be a useful thing for the movement and the organization as a whole. But to answer your question directly, no, that's not happening. It's really just a way of kind of planting a flag and then trying to – I'm tempted to say that they're trying to persuade the organization to move in this direction, but that's not really how it's playing. It's really just kind of people are lobbing shit bombs at each other across the various ideological divides. And it's never really clear exactly what the reality of that divide is anyway. I mean, if Bernie Sanders runs in 2020, everybody's going to drop their guns and campaign like hell for the guy, right? Whether you're a communist or an anarchist or a socialist feminist or in the POC caucus, everyone's going to drop their guns and join hands and fight for Medicare for all, for example.
But if that's all you guys do, though, why do you need that organization? I mean, just funnel into Bernie's campaign or into some issue-oriented organization that's working on healthcare for all. I mean, what is the DSA doing there except being another kind of social media or something?
That's right. Well, I mean, I think it could play many roles outside of that. But is the question. I think yes and no. It's creating a certain kind of culture, which sometimes that culture isn't really good. Sometimes it's overly internal. Sometimes it's overly tribalistic. But so, I mean, I think you're right. Bhaskar Sankara, who was actually often painted as like not a real socialist, you know, founding editor of Jacobin, wrote a really great article for Dissent magazine, which once again, not always the best, most principled magazine, right? But he wrote this back in 2012, I believe. I mean, he was like, I don't know, he's like 14 years old or some shit, right? I mean, Bhaskar's only 12 years old now, right? He's like, I think he's 27, but he wrote this when he was very young, and he was describing what he calls anarcho-liberalism. And the anarcho-liberal sort of has these really ultra-left ideological positions. But in practice, they end up fighting for these really milquetoast liberal reforms. And so there's that's fine. Like, I don't think Bhaskar wants to say like, well, that's bad. You need to be more ultra-left all the time. But what he's saying is there's a incongruence there in beliefs and claims and then action. And so what happens there is that when there's a disconnect between what you say you believe and what you're doing, you can't have an honest engagement and an honest analysis of your strategies and tactics on the ground because you seem to be completely fucking disconnected from that reality. Right? I mean, you have people arguing for full communism and fuck all the reformists, you know? And then they go and start, and then, you know, the next day they're knocking on doors trying to get some candidate elected for city council. Now that's fine. I'm totally for that, right? But it seems to me that there needs to be more of a marriage between people's what they spout online and then what they do in practice.
Well, all I would say is if you're for full communism, in the meantime, out of practical necessity, you're campaigning for a candidate, you need to think very hard about what would need to happen and what kinds of actions will need to be done in order to get to your goal. And often enough, because what's really going on the level of proclamations about some future society or utopian goal is that you're marking your identity rather than actually thinking about your politics. You know, you can easily have both things go on for decades and even across generations.
Yeah, right? It's all about branding, brand, right? I mean, that's the neoliberal ethos is you have to brand yourself. You have to decide and project that identity into the world or else you're just not a self. Because neoliberalism tells us that we don't have an innate identity that it is bound to respect, i.e. our labor power, right? It's something we do every day. We have to sell it. We have to feed ourselves. We have all of these universal things that capitalism imposes upon us. Neoliberalism will not recognize those as vital components of our existence. And so therefore, we're left with this vacuum and we have to fill it with these niche, you know, identity subcultural characteristics, you know. I mean, we all do it, and that's fine. And if it, insofar as it makes us feel good, fuck it, do it. You know, Alfie Bound's, you know, book on playing games and not feeling bad about it. That's great. So we have, you know, but there's a model out there. What I want to insist on is that Marx was, you know, and Engels were ahead of the International Working Man's Association, what later became known as the First International. And in that capacity, Marx helped some French socialists pen their founding party document for the French contingent of the First International. And in that document, they founded for the first time that we know of, I think, this distinction between maximal demands and minimal demands. So the maximal program is, you know, full communism. Right? The whole buffet of options. That's the world we want to live in. And I am diehard for that. I know you are. And I think everyone else in DSA is. The minimal program, however, are the immediate reforms that you offer to the masses that will improve their lives and build your capacities to win the maximal program in the long run. And there has to be this dialectical and conscious interplay between the maximal and the minimal. Right? It isn't just like, say whatever the fuck you want to say over here for your maximal, and then we'll just do whatever the fuck is available for our minimal.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say this, but that's kind of what's going on in much of DSA right now. Like, maybe it might be the case that some of this door knocking or some of these reforms or some, you know, maybe even some just the messaging is wrong. For example, Medicare for All is being jumped on by all of these centrist neoliberals, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, all the rest of them. Yeah, right?
Which it's makes me really nervous, right?
Yeah, and it should. But I don't think incorporation has to be bad. Incorporation, if you frame it in the right way, it means that you're winning. But so then how do we look at Medicare for All? How do we turn that into a socialist, non-reformist reform? Well, it's easy. It's staring at you right in the face. Medicare for All is the most important labor reform that we will have been able to achieve in maybe 75 years. Why? Because it achieves for the first time something that we couldn't even do. The labor unions couldn't even do in the 1950s and 60s. They tried when we were at the height of our strength, right? They couldn't do it in the 50s and 60s. It decouples the relationship between the boss and healthcare.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, what that does for labor's ability to fight back, to form unions, to go on wildcat strikes, to wait out strikes against the bosses, I mean, that is a tremendous advance and for our capacities to wage a struggle against capital. And so, you know, that's the way we should start looking at it. And that's the way we should start messaging this victory when inevitably all of the neoliberals, you know, jump on board for their own opportunistic aim.